Join Anne while she discusses one of her favorite time travel romance novels, Larissa Brown's Beautiful Wreck. Welcome to this episode of Feasting on Fiction. Today, I am going to talk about one of my favorite stories, Beautiful Wreck by Larissa Brown. This is a time travel romance sort of story, so it's definitely in my top three. I've read a lot of those. My top three include this one, Outlander, A Discovery of Witches. Some of those are more well-known than this one, and that's why I'm talking about this, because I want more people to read this book. It's really, really beautiful. We meet our heroine, Jen, in the 22nd century. She lives in what is the city of Iceland, and this is a society that's built pretty much on existing in virtual reality. The natural world is sort of unknown to the folks that live in the city. There's one glacier left. Jen is lucky enough that she lives sort of right against it, and she gets out and can see it and experience it a little bit. And she's flown in a plane, and so she's sort of seen the vastness of the city, of what is just all buildings and all metal structures at this point in the world. There's rumors of what they call realist farms outside the city, sort of beyond the glacier, but she says she hasn't seen evidence of them. She kind of wants to know what's out there, what the so-called realists live like. There's references to the old United States, so it's definitely a different world. It's a different time. We aren't given a lot of insight into what that future looks like as far as political boundaries, other than those little tidbits. This is a world where everyone has sort of chosen their favorite historical period, and they kind of just live there all the time. It's like they're reenactors 100% of the time. They talk about sort of the Civil War reenactment that we know in our current time, and how it's now everyone. It's no longer sort of a fringe hobby. It's what everyone does. And so in this sort of introduction that we have here, we see someone that is living like a ninja. We see some Vikings. We see folks that she describes as sort of Jane Austen characters. We do see some American Civil War soldiers. And then one of our characters, Jeff, he's a 21st century programmer techie guy. So he probably dresses and does things a lot like what you and I do during our time. Jen herself specializes in Viking language. So she's done a lot of studying of the Vikings and the Viking time. That's when she traveled on the plane. She was going to do more studying of the Vikings. And so she works at a place called The Tank. Now, this is a world that has been built very much on virtual reality. And so The Tank is this upstart that is going to provide these completely immersive experiences for folks based on whatever historical period that they're choosing. And this would be their chance to sort of interact with people from those time periods, obviously programmed by the future programmer. So, you know, interact with people that are their ideas of what those people would be. We do get a little sample. They're doing a sort of a test run, and it's like a what we would consider modern ultimate fighting match. So that's sort of our glimpse into The Tank and what The Tank is meant to be. And when I read this book, I think of it as sort of like the holodeck, if you're familiar with Star Trek, The Next Generation, and the holodeck where you get to go program whatever recreational activity you want to do on the deck of the ship. That's what it feels like to me. And so right now, it's still The Tank is still being developed. They're still working on all these different programs. And our Jen works on this Viking, they call it the Viking Heartstone simulation. So she's working on the languages. And so she goes to work in Viking clothing and Viking gear, and then works in The Tank all day, sort of fine tuning the programming and fine tuning the language. This is a world mid 22nd century, like I said, very advanced technology. Everyone has these contacts that they wear that, you know, you can take a picture by blinking in a certain sequence. Your contacts will right up against your eyes tell you what the temperature is. It can give you stats on buildings you're looking at, give you your coordinates. So this is a world full of very advanced tech that this society has learned to live with. And this is sort of how they, in my mind, cope with being so separated from the natural world. Now, like I said, this is a time travel romance story at its core. So what we see happen is Jen goes into the tank for work. They describe that going into the tank as sort of, you have to sort of submerge yourself. She talks about water and it being like sort of like taking a shower. And at some point during this process, she wakes up and she is very confused by what she sees. The tank is not set up for the scene that is sort of spread out before her. And she realizes with a little bit of hesitancy, as one would, that she is now very literally in 10th century Iceland. At one point, it is specified that she's in the year 920, and she is in this settlement called Vitmark, which is this fictional Viking village run by the chieftain Heyrik. She ends up in the longhouse. Viking longhouses were generally made of wood with a thatched or wooden roof. They had a big central sort of oblong fireplace, which is where all the cooking would happen. There were no real chimneys. There might be some smoke holes, but there were no real chimneys. There were generally no windows. So these were very smoky, sort of dark, warm places. They had a tendency to need a lot of repairs from rot because they stayed damp and warm. There is some evidence that in some places they would char wood that they used to build it to try to resist that a little bit. But so it's, you know, certainly a very intense environment to find yourself in when you're used to glass and steel and computers and all that kind of good stuff. So she ends up, this particular longhouse, the chieftain is not married at this point. So it's run by another female in the family, sort of the holder of the keys, the keeper of the keys. And so she gets sort of dumped into the middle of this and really has to put all of her knowledge to the test. And this is a really great, there's a lot of places where it really demonstrates that your theoretical knowledge, especially of a time and place that are really not gone, that are really not there anymore to experience firsthand, that the theoretical knowledge is really, really different than the practical knowledge. Because she, you know, in her mind, she knows the language. She's an expert in the language. And yet she talks about how she's never heard it spoken the way it's being spoken by these obviously native speakers. She knows the concept of spinning wool, but when it's time to actually do it, she's not real good, to be honest. I mean, very few of us would be. Maybe those of us that are reenactors of certain periods would be able to spin, but I think most of us would struggle a lot with it, especially when your expertise is language, not spinning. We see them dyeing the yarn and all of these sort of things that you would expect from basically a farm in just about any century, really, but especially very early on. Now, the food, of course, here we are, the feasting. The food is simple. But it really sounds pretty delicious and not much different than what many people would enjoy today. Obviously, goat cheese plays sort of a huge part. It's the first thing that she eats once they get her back to the longhouse and she's in this place. That's the first thing that she eats. She talks about clouds of goat cheese that she eats basically with a spoon. They grow barley. So there's a lot of talk of barley harvest. They make skyr, which is Icelandic yogurt. It's the consistency of Greek yogurt, but a little milder flavor. And you can find that available in modern grocery stores in many flavors. I'm sure not quite the same as 10th century, but you can find it and enjoy it. And it's still something that exists today. Cultured milk products, obviously, historically, when you have lots of milk and no refrigeration, culturing them is the best way to keep them. So, you know, we get the goat cheese, you get the skyr. Butter is there and part of their diet. She talks about flatbread, you know, not a lot of leavened bread. At one point, she does sort of lust over a baguette. She wishes that she could get herself a nice, chewy, crispy on the outside, chewy on the inside baguette, which would probably be delicious with the good goat cheese that she's having. Chicken, dried berries. They have sheep, they have cattle. They're not that far from the ocean, so they sort of have folks. They have fishermen that are sort of stationed there for periods of the year, just doing the fishing. And they talk about eels, shark, fish. They don't go whaling, but when a whale washes up, that is a sort of a blessing and a gift because they can use so much of it either, you know, for food, but also for ornaments, for oil. It's a big deal. They all, pretty much the whole community goes to take care of this whale, to break it down and to get everything that they can use. And that's where the name comes from. The word for whale is sort of the equivalent of wreck. And so that's where we get beautiful wreck. There's also, she talks about dried berries. So one of the meals that she talks about during their throwing a party, and goat cheese, flatbread, chicken, dried berries. And she talks about how ravenous she is and how much she eats of it. That that sounds, you know, that's a typical meal. That's a typical simple meal. Like, we might put it all together and turn it into sort of a pizza-like product, but it's not this sort of crazy, strange food that we wouldn't recognize. We would very much recognize it. Porridge, she mentions. I think every culture has their breakfast porridge that they enjoy on various levels. I don't think I've really found one that I would say I enjoy, but they're certainly filling. And then, you know, for drinks, they would have had mead. They have ale. She talks about sour whey and not really enjoying the sour whey. And that's literally, they take the whey after they've, you know, it's left over after culturing milk, and it's allowed to ferment. It's allowed to sour. And then they did drink it, but I found in some of my research that they also used it as a preservation means. They would put meat into the sour whey as a preservation. And that makes total sense. Fermentation is still used as a way to preserve things, whether it's, you know, pickles or kimchi or any of that. Fermentation is still widely used. So I don't want to give you any spoilers on this, because I really feel like you should go read this book. There are two in the series. Today I'm just specifically talking about the first one, Beautiful Wreck, but there is a second book that sort of expands on everything. That one's called So Wild a Dream. So it is a duology, but it is a book that it's not going to take you forever to read. You know, I mentioned Outlander and Discovery of Witches. I love both of them. Those are serious reads. Those are going to take you a long time. And if you continue in the series, there's 8 Outlander in the Outlander series currently released. There's 4 in the Discovery of Witches universe. This one is 2, a very reasonable length. You should really check them out. But in the end, you know, it comes down to Jen. Jen has to make some tough decisions. She spends the first part of the book in the modern time sort of wondering where her place is and wanting more and trying to find it within the constraints of this virtual world that everyone is sort of existing in. And then she gets to this farm and feels like she's found her place and found many things that she was looking for. But obviously, when you go from the 22nd century to the 10th century, there are going to be lots of obstacles, I think you would say. So she has decisions that she needs to make and things that she needs to figure out, and she needs to find her way to fit in as a 22nd century girl. How does she fit in the 10th century? There's romance between people, but there's also sort of romance with her and the time and her and the family and her and the farm. And in the end, it's really sort of about her search for her place in the world and for her completeness. It's her looking for more. It's her looking for the things that she needs to feel satisfied and fulfilled. It is beautiful. It's called Beautiful Wreck, and it is a beautiful story. The characters are beautiful. There's humor. It would be very easy to not maybe develop the characters, because it's hard to write how do you write for 10th century folks? But she does a really, really great job of developing these characters and making the reader understand that time doesn't really matter. People are still people, and people are still looking for the same basic things. And you really grow to love the Viking, all the Viking characters, the true Viking characters. So with that, I'm just going to leave you with my advice to go find this book. It's available as an ebook. It's available in print. Check your local library, but I really think you'll enjoy it. If you like the time travel aspect of other similar books, I think you'll really enjoy this one. It's a pretty unique setting. I've not seen a lot that go back as far as this one goes time-wise. And I've never really read a lot of Viking era. So I think that this is a unique one, but I think that you'll really like it. Grab yourself some goat cheese, make yourself some flatbread, have a little snack while you enjoy this really beautiful book. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to go back and check out the other episodes. There are several available in this season so far. So until next time, keep on feasting. Thanks for listening and for supporting Feasting on Fiction. All the opinions of the panel are ours alone, and we're not associated with the media we're discussing in any way. If you'd like to support us, please head over to cookingthebook.com, check out our Patreon, and all of our social media. Thanks!